Jazz.
Jazz.
Bastard.
We're ready.
All right. This is, I wasn't sure what to call it. Tenorpalooza. I think I'm going to call this episode Keeping It Up. This is about tenor players going the distance.
Going the distance.
Dominating the stage. Filling the hall in more than one sense.
Owning the venue.
Claiming their space. The centerpiece of tonight's discussion is going to be this massive Sonny Rollins box and a 6-disc set out of Spain that documents the entire run of the Village Gate of a quartet with Sonny Rollins and Don Cherry, Billy Higgins on drums, and I think it's Bob Cranshaw on bass, the bass player that's been associated with Sonny, for who's been associated with Sonny for many, many years now. I think Bob may have finally passed away, but he worked with Sonny for decades. But anyway, this quartet was recorded by RCA at the Village Gate, and they released an album from that engagement called Our Man in Jazz, which had 3 tracks. One at least was heavily edited. And now this Italian company, or Spanish company rather, has come up with somehow, I'm not sure how, all 7 hours of recorded material from that engagement. So it's kind of a massive trawl through several live sets by this group, and it's kind of amazing. But before getting to that, we've got a couple shorter albums. One is a Dexter Gordon joint, which includes 2 of the 4 compositions are by Sonny, and there's a connection there. And also, I just kind of thought of it as the mainstream example of what I think of as very successful live jazz with a tenor player who's kind of dominating, who's soloing at length, that's only put into perspective when you compare him to Sonny soloing at length, right. Called Both Sides of Midnight. And I think this is, it's an album from recorded in Copenhagen, and I think it's been released under a couple different names, the Black Lion label. And then you picked out one as well, right?
Oh, right. Sorry. Is it my turn? I'm listening. Yeah, I picked out this solo date by Branford Marsalis.
In My Solitude.
Solitude, live from the Grace Cathedral in Washington, D.C., I believe.
So I'd argue that's really a duet album between Branford and Grace Cathedral, because my God.
There is, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, it's, the acoustics are striking.
And so I thought we'd kind of get to Sonny later. Do you want to start with Branford?
Right. Sure, let's start with Branford.
Now, this is the one where, even though we think of Branford, I think, primarily as a tenor player, he solos on tenor, but also soprano, and really, to me, kind of shockingly, alto. Because so often, if you have a saxophone player, they play alto, or they play tenor and soprano. Sometimes, you know, alto players will double on soprano, but really rarely does somebody play both alto and tenor. I guess Sonny Stitt would be an example of it. And, you know, there's like the one-off that Charlie Parker would do, or a one-off that Ornette Coleman would do, but...
And explain to the kids at home why that is.
Well, I don't necessarily know. I was actually thinking about that in the car the other day.
I thought it was because they're in different keys.
Well, they are. That's true. The tenor's in B-flat, and soprano is in B-flat, but the alto is in E-flat, like the baritone. But it doesn't necessarily, unless you're, well, it doesn't really, that doesn't necessarily affect it. They're all fingered the same way. If you see a note on a staff that's been transposed for your instrument, you finger C the same way on a tenor, soprano, or alto, or barry. And it's just that it's, you know, you're keyed differently, so the sound, the tone you produce will be different. I thought of it as mainly that the tenor and the alto have enough shared range that you don't get as much benefit from doubling there. You kind of pick the register you want to live in, and the voice is closest to your own. And if you're going to double, you're going to do something that's more of a dramatic contrast. It's just speculation there. I don't really have an answer. But as I said, I think from the example of Coltrane, a lot of tenor players will double on soprano. Less common that alto players will, though. You've got like a Phil Woods who'll play soprano or clarinet. And then again, very fairly rare that you get someone that plays a lot on both tenor and alto. Yeah, here he does all 3. I think he plays them with the Marsalis patented excellent technique. What do you think about this one? And do you have the date available when it came out? Is it
2000 and I want to say 14, but let me double check on that and just make sure super fast. It is 2014.
Okay. So pretty recent. This is well past Branford's tenure on Columbia. I don't know if it's self-produced or did it come out
This is on the OK label.
OK, all right. And I'm like, God, I don't even know what OK means. It's a label that dates back to the 20s, but
yeah,
what
it's been
is
around
now.
Forever.
Yeah.
I just picked up a new CD recently on OK label by an African vocalist. So they're still churning them out.
Right. I mean, I think it was a long gap in which OK did not exist. But I think it was a kind of a race label subsidiary, I believe, of Columbia. I don't want to swear to that. But that was like way back in the day, back in the 78 era. So thoughts about this In My Solitude? That was the one you suggested for tonight's show.
So I am of two minds of this. Mostly I like it a great deal. The numbers on it that I like least are the abstract ones, the improvisation 1, 2, 3, and 4. And particularly when he goes to soprano, there's just something about them that sort of keening and screeching in the echoey acoustics of the Grace Cathedral that I'm not particularly appreciative of. The other songs I tend to like quite a bit more. But that's kind of a knock, since that's half the album right there, those four songs. But I prefer the other stuff. It is another Marsalis kind of showing off his classical chops too, isn't it? Right. So we have a couple of classical numbers as well. But I prefer the stuff that seems more melodic rather than the improvisations, which are deliberately abstract. And especially when he's on soprano in those, that's just sort of keening and it gets my attention in an untoward way. I think what I especially like, and I talked about this with you a little already, I really like how he takes advantage of the acoustics at Grace Cathedral. So he's in a big echoey place and he uses it, and rather than sort of fight it, he actually takes advantage of it. And he takes advantage of it in a couple of ways. He'll sustain notes and allow them to kind of reverberate around, kick around the cathedral. I think there's even a couple of occasions where he plays against his own echo, or tries to, and that seems really clever, actually. That seems kind of smart, taking advantage of the space you're in. But he also, I think, is walking around. I think that he's up at the front of the... I suspect he's up at the front, and he's moving around because the dynamics change in ways that I don't think can be accounted for just by him blowing quieter. It sounds like he's blowing away from the recording apparatus. It sounds like he's turned, and I think he does that intentionally. I think he's actually using the space and, in a sense, filling the space with sound and choosing ways to inhabit that space deliberately. And that's not something you get a lot of in jazz, where people accommodate their sound to the space, because usually the space is either a recording studio or a club, and clubs are clubs. And they often don't have great acoustics. And if they do have great acoustics, there's not that much distinctive about a lot of places. I think about, you know, things like where Ellington at Fargo, 1940 discs, where he's playing dance halls and he's being recorded in a dance hall. Or those Lester Young recordings him playing, you know, in dance halls and stuff. And sometimes the distance of the recording apparatus gives you a different take on the sound. But here, I just think it's really intelligent on Marsalis's part to embrace the space and to use a difficult space in a deliberate fashion. So for me, the standout numbers are Stardust. I think he does a beautiful job on that song. A really lovely, thoughtful rendition. I love the closer. I'm so glad we had this time together, which is the Carol Burnett sign off. That's the final song on the album. I really like that. And I also enjoyed the Blues for One. Who Needs It is okay. I don't dislike it. It's fine. It's strong. But
those are the numbers. That's a Steve Lacy tune, right? On some panel that opens the...
Yeah. And the moment I recall your face is another lovely moment. But yeah, I think he's really in a kind of lyrical space where he's attempting to take advantage of the bizarre and challenging acoustics of the space he finds himself in. And it's an interesting little sonic experiment. I think he brings it off well. I could do with one or two less of the improvisations. And that would make it a better album for me if a couple of those got left off. But all in all, I found this pretty enjoyable stuff. And, you know, it's easy enough to program it so you don't listen to the improvisations if they drive you nuts, too. I have a pretty high tolerance for abstraction, but I will confess that Steve Lacy at his more thorny moments on Soprano or Branford Here do get on my nerves a little bit. And it takes a lot of patience for me to listen to some of that stuff. Something about the Soprano, when it's in that kind of abstract, non-lyrical mode, kind of puts my back up a little bit. Maybe it's a personal problem. I don't know. But those were the parts that were less successful to me. How did you like it?
Pretty well. I think that Branford is always somebody that you mainly worry about, not can he do it, but why is he doing it? He's a virtuoso, but you're not quite sure what his motivation is or the aesthetic motor that's driving and justifying a given recording. It's more that this is a man that can record as often as he likes until the day he dies, because he's very talented and also very well known, right? It's this double whammy of somebody who's got a great deal of talent and ability and also a very famous name, and who used to be a musical sidekick on a talk show and used to play with Sting and just, you know, is a known figure with a degree of celebrity that most jazz musicians don't have. And so sometimes recordings just seem to be brilliantly accomplished but kind of arbitrary. This one seemed a little bit more heartfelt and focused than some of his work. And, you know, I read some things about it, and one thing he mentioned was because of the context, a live recording solo and this amazing acoustic, he really thought about not getting too notey, not playing too many notes, not being too complex. Because really you can't be in this acoustic without just turning it into a smeary mess.
Right.
And I think that probably helps focus his playing. I found it interesting that he nods to Steve Lacy. You know, if you think of musicians likely to be on a Marsalis's radar, Lacy's not the name that springs to mind.
Nope.
And yet there it is, and I kind of appreciated that. I probably got a little more tolerance for the straight horn of Steve Lacy sound. And I actually remember his acoustic experiment. I saw him live many, many years ago, something no one can do right now, obviously, but obviously, when he was still living, many, many years ago, in some small club in Chicago, and he played for a while with the pedal on a piano, lifting the hammers from the strings, so the piano vibrated, the strings in it vibrated to the notes he was playing. He was not actively hitting the hammers, but he was lifting them back so the strings weren't muted. Mm-hmm. And that was kind of fascinating. And yeah, in a way, you feel like this is apparently all the reviews say it's his first solo recital. And, you know, for saxophones, many players go their whole lives without necessarily doing one or doing more than, say, you know, a given a cappella
number. It's his first one.
That's what the reviews claimed. I don't by any means
have
the whole,
know that.
I don't have the whole Branford discography. My shoulders aren't that strong. My endurance isn't that potent. but that was a claim. It was, you know, repeated throughout. I'm sure it was in the press kit. I wonder if, in a sense, he chose this as an environment that kind of took some of the edge off or made it less bold or kind of filled out the sound, because in a sense it's like almost two or three musicians with that. I think I read somewhere it's like a 7-second delay, which is just kind of hard to process in my mind how long an echo that would be. And he claimed again, and I read this in a couple of reviews, that, you know, after a gig with his group, he liked to go out visiting people, partying, whatever. But after this recital, he just wanted to go home and sleep. So his narrative of this was it was more draining and exhausting than a typical performance because it was so naked.
Right. Yeah. The liner notes talk about, just let me follow up on that point real quick. The liner notes talk about how on one of the performances, I guess, that I don't know if this is all recorded in one evening or over a couple of evenings, but either on this evening or in a warm-up to this evening. I think it had to be a warm-up for this evening. He opened with Stardust, and then later in the show played Stardust again because he was so in the moment, he forgot that he had played Stardust.
Yes. Yeah, that's – and I do think that's – typically our worry about a Marsalis performance is not that it's too spontaneous, but that it's too calculated. So yeah, that, and again, he may be aware of this and playing off that worry, but it does seem to be a little more hard on sleeve, a little bit more spontaneous than some Marsalis productions, and that's only to the good. We know he's got the talent and the facility. The question is, you know, does he have the kind of heart in the moment to make something that speaks to you? So overall, I found this fine. I don't know that, to me, the improvisations were that distinctly less or more annoying than the rest of the stuff. But at the same time, I think that this is not a record that, again, has tons of layers that I'm going to go back to again and again and again. I like it. I think it's successful. I don't know that it touches me as deeply as my favorite jazz, but overall, in the world of Branford's recordings that I've experienced, which is a very small portion of the total continent there, I like it pretty well. It did remind me of really the recitals I tend to think of that have so much to do with acoustics are a couple James Newton solo albums, one in Echo Canyon,
where
it's him, the Canyon's acoustics, and about 4,000 crickets. And I like that album a lot. You really can hear them. And one called In Venice, where he is in a very cavernous acoustic. And I don't like that one as well. And I'm not sure if it's the acoustic or just his mood at the time or whatever. Echo Canyon, I've always liked quite a bit. And of course, the flute we talked about recently as having a very pure tone benefits, I think, from the complications of the echo. It gives it a richness and an interest. I'm not sure saxophone needs as much acoustic help. I mean, at times I felt like this was almost comically intrusive. It was just so much. You know, the acoustic was so featured. It really did seem
certainly
like
when he's on the tenor, it's more noticeable in some ways because you can't go deep without really rattling the windows.
Right.
You
know? And those are slower signals, wider signals. And yeah, they tend to be affected by the acoustic environment more. And so, yeah, it becomes a little crazy. But yeah, overall, I'd recommend it. I liked it in a sense because of the acoustic and because that he is making an effort. You know, this is not for alto. This is a fairly accessible without being, I think, superficial or pandering album. It's one that is not asking you to kind of get out the microscope and watch the vivisection of everything possible with a given note.
Right.
And so, yeah, that's appealing.
Yeah, it's Branford at a more sort of introspective place. It's not a bad place for him to be.
No, absolutely. Yeah, this is a player who we could use a little more pensiveness, a little bit more inward lookingness. Not true of every musician in the world, but yeah, Branford benefits from it. So a guy that was rarely pensive or particularly introspective, but always enjoyable, shifting gears to Dexter Gordon. This album, for some reason, I ran across it before Pop Market imploded, and they had an offer where they would sell you, I don't know why Black Lion decided to do this, a 45 RPM two-disc version with a 33 RPM one-disc version of this particular club date. And I realized this is one I kind of grown up with, and I liked it well enough I didn't feel bad about it. Both pressings are fine sounding. A live club date with mostly an expat rhythm section. I think it's Kenny Drew on piano and somebody really good on drums, and then a Danish bass player who I think is just fantastic.
Niels Henning Orsted Petersen.
There you go. And there's a couple tunes that show off his just amazing facility and clarity. And I just think of this as, I mean, no revelations are forthcoming. This is a straight blowing album, four performances, two which are pretty lengthy, and just everybody seems to be that degree inspired, on fire, focused, and it just seems to be a notch above a lot of what, in my opinion, Dexter produced, with the interest, additional interest being, here's a live quartet, another tenor player, very distinctive, sharing some repertoire with this massive set of Sonny's and letting you think about kind of the mainstream take on what Sonny was going to be deconstructing. Actually, a few years earlier, I think this is a late 60s recording. I should look that up. So I don't know whether you were familiar with this one or not. For me, I'd probably put it in one of my top five Dexter recordings. I don't know if you liked it that much.
I think all Dexter recordings go in the top five of Dexter recordings. Are there any bad Dexter recordings?
Like, there are some sleepy ones, especially towards the end, yeah.
I suppose, but he's never bad. But by the same token, and this is my beef with Dexter, and it is not really a beef. It's just that I rarely think that he's great.
Right.
I think he's always good. And I only have six or seven of his albums. But everything I hear from him is always good. In fact, I think next to This Is Our Music by Ornette and WSQ, I have one of my oldest encounters with jazz was Dexter Gordon's Go. And I think it was paired with Rollins' Saxophone Colossus on the other side,
wow,
if memory
okay.
serves.
Yeah, it's pretty fucking good cassette there. Yeah,
it's pretty fucking good cassette. But Dexter Gordon is like always 3.5, 4 stars, never five. At least I haven't heard that 5-star Dexter Gordon recording. He's mellow. He's relaxed. He's charming. He loves to quote other songs. He's fun loving. He's not profound. And that just seems like a terrible thing to say. Like I'm knocking the shit out of him. Like I don't like him. And that's not true. I really do like him. But for me, and we'll talk about it in a minute, but like for me, the difference between Dexter and Sonny is perhaps nowhere better illustrated than on Doxy, the song that they have in common on these two recordings. And Dexter plays it and Sonny has a couple goes at it. And here's the thing. Dexter's version is charming and fun and classic hard bop, really enjoyable. And Sonny's is, first of all, it's taken at a much faster clip. Sonny just takes it, Dexter's always kind of loping along, he's not slow, but he's not fast, he's kind of somewhere short of fast. And Rollins takes it at a much brisker clip. And once the opening statement is done on Doxy, he does two versions, Doxy 1. Once the opening statement is done on Doxy 1, he deconstructs it, like he takes it apart.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
I mean, it's like here are the building blocks of this song. Let's see what we can make. And his version is a couple minutes longer than Dexter's. And he goes into outer space and back. And with Sonny, you're in the presence of a monstrous talent. Same way that Dexter's always like 3.5, 4 stars. And you always wonder where that 5-star recording is. Sonny Rollins is like Mr. 4-star, except that every fifth album is like a classic. It's like a 5-star recording. And his classic recordings start early and they run late and he's still going. He's this kind of questing player who's never stopped. And questing is the last word you would use with Dexter Gordon. He is not a questing player.
He's found. He's not looking. He's found it. Yeah, he's presented it to you.
He got his thing. Here's my thing. I'm going to show you my thing. Have you seen the film Round Midnight starring him?
Yeah, many, many years ago. Yeah.
And one gets the sense that Dexter's not really acting. He's just being Dexter. He's playing a jazz musician, an expatriate jazz musician in Paris. And you get the feeling that Dexter didn't really learn his lines because he didn't have to. He was just being a 65-year-old elder statesman of the music. He didn't have to think what the lines were because he lived them. He just has this easygoing, friendly attitude. He's a lot of fun. He's always enjoyable, rarely profound, but never uninteresting. Like, he's never shallow. The only time he's shallow is when he throws in little quotes and you're sometimes like, okay, enough already.
Which I don't think he does very much here.
No, he doesn't.
One thing you could say is that
he restrains himself. Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
I'd agree with that.
As Dexter performances go, here he is working. He's putting out chorus after chorus with very little fat.
Yep.
Yeah. For me, it is that extra half star. And I don't know that it is hugely different from some other things he does, but I think partially it's the context. I think the band around him is just very alert, very energized.
Yeah.
They never slack. They're very on point. And I've been thinking, and sometimes I wish I was kind of running the little tiny jazz band I'm part of here at this small college. I'm not. But it occurred to me at one point to think of a beat as a shelf, and every beat is its own shelf. And if you're on time, you can put, let's say you're putting a can on each shelf, and that's the note you're playing. You can put it at the very back of the shelf. You can put it at the very front of the shelf. Dexter always puts the beat on the back of the shelf. He's not slow, he's not dragging, but his whole line is just slightly shoved back from everybody else. He's just so fucking relaxed that his one is slightly later than your one. but it's not, the next one isn't any later than the whole thing is kind of slid back a bit. And I was fascinated because you listen to the bass player and the drummer here, and how do they keep the energy going for 15 minutes with it never seeming to be drummer Al Tootie Heath.
Right.
Yeah, they never lose focus. They never drag. They never get – and one thing I've noticed with you're playing with teenagers in a rhythm section is they don't realize it's like, okay, this might be five choruses of blues. You should never be bored doing this. If you're bored, it's because you're doing it wrong. it's not that your job is boring, it's that you're doing it in a boring way, or you're not equipped to do it in a way that entertains you enough. And these guys, they never once give you the impression that they are anything but living in the moment and excited to be there and giving it 110%. And I think this Dexter, again, he is just amazingly, he is the best of Dexter. He is still not, he's never going to be Coltrane or Rollins or Sam Rivers or whoever, one of these players that's more exploratory of pushing things, but it's like Dexter on one of his best days. He's not quoting every chorus. It's just like a series of declaratory sentences. It's just amazing the clarity of his thought. Again, it's never that profound. He's not Heidegger, but what he's saying is clear. It's like C.S. Lewis, right? Maybe not the smartest guy, but a very clear writer. And just every single phrase comes out and pours out logically. And then he goes. I mean, some of these solos go, 5-7 minutes long. They seem really impressively long until you listen to this Rollins part, where solos is like the longest performance on this recording is 15 minutes. And at least one of the Rollins solos I was listening to itself goes 15 minutes.
Yes.
It's like, oh my God. But I would say that the difference is that the pleasure here is a set of guys that know what the rules are, they're completely comfortable in them, and they are achieving really great results playing within those lines. They're not interested in coloring outside of the lines, but they're doing just a fucking amazing job of playing within the rule set. And as we transition over here to this massive, inscrutable, just bizarre box of Rollins and Cherry, it's a transition from the known at kind of peak efficiency, chugging along, but just, more than chugging, gliding along, but still the known. And this is from 67, so it's actually a couple of years after the Rollins date at the Village Gate, versus Rollins coming back from the bridge and I feel like just on some kind of quest, some kind of vision quest on this set. So I like it a lot. I would say that for me, of Dexter Gordon stuff, before we move on, the Both Sides of Midnight recording is one of my favorites. But I'd agree that, yeah, the daylight between it and just merely really good Dexter is a little hard to spot. And it's only some of the later stuff where he's getting a little more tired and maybe some of the contexts aren't that well thought out. Or some of the endless steeplechase sessions he does, where you notice it's more the 3-star, 2.5-star stuff. And really just because there's so much out there that you might as well cherry pick it. He never makes a weak album, per se. I mean, he's not capable of it.
He's got about a 35-year run where basically you can't really go wrong. You can just pick anything by him.
As long as he's out of prison, he's doing great. He is always. But when he's out, and he's always, he finds context. I mean, when Dexter's ready to record, people tend to find good groups to back him. He does not tend to play with scrubs.
Right.
It tends to be good stuff. They're all their A game when Dexter's in town.
Well, as you point out, they kind of have to be given his own almost shambolic approach to time. You actually need a rhythm section that's on their A game or it's going to fall apart.
Yeah. And those great performances you can hear. Yeah, the drummer, Heath, is he's putting the cans a lot further forward on the shelf than Dexter is. And he has to do it. And that tension keeps things driving without rushing.
I think also another point to make here is that Dexter benefits from being heard live in the studio. I don't know. I haven't heard enough live Dexter, but it feels like there's a little more at stake here. It feels like there's a little spark up his ass, whereas in studio, he might be even a bit more relaxed than he is here live. Although, no one would say that his playing here is urgent. It's just a little more present, maybe.
Right.
One often expects from him. I mean, I have another live date of his that I also think is quite good. So maybe he's an artist who benefits from that setting, from being heard live, just because there's a little more at stake.
Yeah, I think they're releasing some more recordings from this date on a Record Store Day release. And I think it's been out in various formats. It's this more than these four tunes were recorded that night and or that stay. And in fact, the CD version has a version of Misty. And I got to admit, not having heard it, that'd be the title I drop probably. But though he is a fine ballad. I mean, Dexter, I do think he's a player. When you hear him play a ballad, he is of the school that you feel like he knows the lyrics. He is feeling the tune as he plays it. He's not just looking at a series of notes.
Yeah.
Someone who we're not sure had any lyrics, we're not sure what was going on. Live at the Village Gate, the complete sessions, a 6-disc set, a little oddly presented in that it's not necessarily strictly chronological, and they give you both the edited and the complete versions of the song released on Armada Jazz, one of the tunes there. They decided that the listener should have both. It's kind of an odd choice. In the original Armada Jazz release, it was a 3-tune album that had Olio, one of the Olios, Dearly Beloved, which they chopped up to about half the length of the original recording, and Doxy. And this includes both the short Dearly Beloved and the complete Dearly Beloved. No one's quite sure why, probably because they could fit it on the 6 discs. There's a lot of kind of opportunism when a European reissue company that isn't paying royalties releases stuff. They'll say, well, I've got 80 minutes. Let me put 10 minutes from this session on there to fill it out, kind of thing. And I guess it was their choice. But overall, this set just gives you, I don't know, this amazing 7-hour slab of Sonny and, to the lesser extent, Don just going to town, trying shit out. It's, almost overwhelming. But I can't believe anybody that likes Sonny at all not wanting to hear this now that it's out. Did you enjoy this?
Yeah, I did. I thought it was fantastic. Probably deserves a 5-star rating, but it's a thorny 5-star rating. It's not like some 5-star albums that you go to because they're just stone cold classics. This is going to make you work. You're going to struggle. This is for the jazz fan. So if you're a casual listener, don't just get our managed jazz and save yourself some money. But if you're really into Sonny, I think this is essential. I think you have to hear this. The pairing after you hear it seems so natural, you wonder why it wasn't done more often. That is to say, Sonny Rollins is as questing a player as there probably has ever been in jazz, and someone who was absolutely, I shouldn't say past tense because he's still with us, he is someone who's resolutely unafraid to play with anybody, although many people are afraid to play with him. there are dates with him playing with Coleman Hawkins. You know,
I mean,
I actually have seen a picture from that date, and there's Bean, you know, in his pork pie hat and his rumpled suit, probably having downed a quart of gin before the date. And there's Rollins in an army jacket and a mohawk, and they're sharing a stage together. He will play and has played with anyone. I think a lot of people are terrified to play with him, and with reason, but Don Cherry is not one of them. Like, you have the sense that Don Cherry is, in his own right, absolutely fearless, and also someone who is totally comfortable as a kind of inquisitive player. And the two of them, I think, are ideal sparring partners. It is six discs, and that's exhausting, but my God, thank God we have them, because this is the only time they played together live, isn't it? This set of dates.
I'm not sure if there are boots floating out there of other gigs they did. It was a very short-lived group. And the miracle here is that because RCA was recording it for this live album, I mean, this is six discs of really good sounding recordings. I mean, yep. They're very high quality. Occasionally Sonny will wander off mic or something, but my God, it's just so
well, that's
much
okay, because Don Cherry's constantly wandering off mic. I mean, yeah. and Cherry makes Miles Davis look like a metronome.
He
is such an idiosyncratic, strange player in his own right, and perfectly willing to fluff or burble or gurgle notes, but also perfectly capable of very quick runs and quite fleet lyrical playing when he wants to. And I don't even know how to describe some of the telepathy that goes on here, because, you know, when you're soloing for 15 minutes,
as one does
when you're Sonny Rollins, that leaves the other guy with a lot of time to blow the spit out of his horn. But by the same token, Rollins steps off and lets Cherry have significant, Cherry is not an adjunct here. He is not, it's not Sonny Rollins and three faceless, nameless others.
No. I mean,
everyone gets extended time here, and Cherry really benefits, I think, from being allowed to solo at great length here. He is so quirky and so interesting. And so different in some ways than Rollins, to hear them sort of play together is just bizarre, because Rollins, he can take things apart and put them back together, and he can be an extremely fast player, and he's got an enormous tone. And these are all things that you would not say of Cherry. Cherry does not have an enormous tone.
No.
You know, and Cherry, as he sort of stuttering, fluffy starts, he's really good with dynamics. He plays really well softly, and he has these sort of weird, quirky fits and starts and burbles and gurgles and fluffs, and occasionally you get a little run from him, and he'll sort of scale up on the horn. And it couldn't be more different from Sonny. And I think the two of them together make some really challenging and interesting music. I think they benefit from each other's presence here. Sometimes when Rollins plays with other people, you have the sense that he's dominating the proceedings. And I don't imagine he's had many occasions in the last 20 years where he shared the stage with anyone or shared a disc with anyone where they felt comfortable, where they were like, ah, yes, my partner, Sonny. And you have the sense that Don Cherry just doesn't give a shit. Like,
yeah,
he's just happy. He's enjoying this date, sure. He's doing Don Cherry stuff. And he belongs there. He doesn't have the stature in the music that Rollins does, but maybe he should, or at least he belongs there. He's a titan in his own right, and the two of them together make some really fun music here. And he's perfectly adept at this sort of deconstructing of music the way that Rollins seems to want to do. He'll lay out the chart, he'll play the head, and then we're off. And Cherry's like, okay, I'm with you. And
yeah, it's like
they're simpatico. It's wonderful to listen to.
I mean, one is he's like a very blurry impressionist versus Rollins, who just endless cubist lines, right? Just very sharply etched, but they're both abstracting in their own way. I felt like the dynamics of the relationship shifted from performance to performance and song to song. So there's some, like Lover, it starts and then Rollins solos for 15 minutes and then Cherry joins him at the end. But there really isn't a feature there. And then like some of the Olios, it's this bizarre thing where it's sequential for the most part. Rollins will just, you know, I walk to work, it's 15 to 20 minutes. And so that's like the length of one of his solos. It's just like, I start, I leave the door, you know, my front door, I walk block after block, and he's still going, Rollins still playing. And then Don comes in and says his piece, which tends to be shorter and much more fragmented and more recessive. And then they end it. There are other pieces where there's a lot of tossing back and forth. I think it's the Duke Ellington piece that to me was almost one of the very highest highlights. Where they're constantly kind of in a dialogue and they're both playing fragments and then they're wandering off to other melodies and coming back and interweaving, and that's just fantastic. And then there's some performances towards the end of the set, the six discs, where it seems like they're more clearly in an Ornette Coleman bag, where kind of the more mournful, introspective sound comes forward and it's more minimalist, and it almost seems like Cherry's kind of setting the mood and leading the charge, and then Rollins is consciously taking more of a backseat and kind of commenting and helping create that mood. And he's willing to do, I mean, there's some places where he'll play split tone overtone stuff for just minute after minute. He's just experimenting with it in a very kind of focused way, and times where he is playing very, I mean, I feel like he's doing his version of Ornette lines, and then others where he's just showing it's kind of like the end of bebop. There shall be no more bebop ever, because he's bebopped the end of bebop. And it's, you know, 15 minutes of him just tearing through the chord changes to Doxy or Olio, and just you feel like there can be nothing left to be said. It's the end. He said everything. He's played every lick twice, once forwards and once backwards. It's just like, wow, holy shit. And the whole time, Higgins is an important player, especially in these long, untitled compositions, which seem to be kind of like looser versions of the suites that we know from Cherry albums. They kind of change mood, change rhythm. And I don't know whether Higgins is driving that or he's picking up on signals from him. I'd say those three seem to be the most active. And then Crenshaw is doing a fine, sturdy job. My God, anybody that can play the bass for a 35-minute performance and keep the rhythm going is just surely from a physical perspective impressive. I don't feel like as a soloist or a sound creator he's quite as engaging as the other three. But, I mean, he's certainly there, and he's participating in a kind of intense music making that we don't tend to associate with him from like the 70s or the 80s, right? He's playing ball with the big boys and doing very, very well. I feel like if this, I don't know how long he'd known Rollins at this point, but if he makes it through this trial by fire, no wonder Rollins kept him around for the next few decades. It's like, sure. Some bass players would have just died. I am kind of just amazed by the physicality of what the rhythm section's doing. So, yeah, it's just a fantastic set. I kind of wonder, you know, this is Rollins' post-first sabbatical, where he famously stops playing for a while and rehearses under the bridge, and then he comes back.
The Williamsburg Bridge in Brooklyn.
Collaborates with Jim Hall. We talked about the album The Bridge when we did our special on Jim Hall. And obviously with Don Cherry, and that bizarre album that seems almost at times aggressive, or is he playing with Coleman Hawkins? Is he mocking him? Is he, you know, it's just, yeah. It's a very tough record to kind of, I'm so glad it exists, but it's, he's in a weird place. He's in a weird mood here. And I believe that after he returns from the sabbatical, these are probably his most questing and thorny years. The stuff he does for RCA and then on Impulse. He's really kind of trying shit out. And then when the 70s start and he goes to Milestone, I don't know that the identity crisis, it seems like it's passed. His tone even changes, and he's just, he's a little bit of a different player. Still amazing, but the career after that, it doesn't have the just kind of diamond-like brilliance of the early bebop stuff, nor the endless questing of this middle period. It's kind of more in a groove. And it occurred to me listening to this, if there's a city named Stan Getz and another city named Sonny Rollins and another city named John Coltrane, which city do you think is closer to the city of Stan Getz? You know what, you think the obvious answer would be Rollins. I don't know. I think in some ways Coltrane is closer to Stan Getz than Rollins is.
That might be because Coltrane is more, I mean, Coltrane is ultimately rooted in the blues in Coltrane's playing. I mean, he's ultimately, no matter what else you want to say about him, he's a blues player. Even in his most formidable, thorny, difficult later music, he's ultimately a blues man. I don't think I would say that about Rollins. Certainly not here. One of the numbers that sticks out for me, and that I think kind of illustrates the interplay of these guys and this date altogether, is that long number, I think it's at the end of one of the discs, that starts out as an unidentified ballad and then turns into Alexander's Ragtime Band.
Oh, God, yeah.
And then turns into Home Sweet Home. I'm fascinated and have listened to the transition between the unidentified ballad, whatever the fuck that is, and Alexander's Ragtime Band. And I have the sense that this is absolutely spontaneous, unplanned shit. I don't think anyone knew what was going to happen. It's one of those moments where the sort of, you get this occasionally on live dates, you hear it now and again, where a song is petering out and Rollins is kind of trading some notes with Cherry. And it could be just one of those where the drummer kind of does a little roll on the cymbals and everyone walks away. And all of a sudden, you just get a couple of notes from Rollins hinting at Alexander. And Cherry picks up on it instantly. And he echoes back. And then before you know it, the two of them are trading the melody to Alexander's. And the drummer picks up instantly and we're off and running. And it's like telepathy. The notes that Rollins plays to even hint at it are just, he just plays two or three notes and Cherry instantly bats them back. You get this sense of two men who are incredibly adventurous, incredibly playful, and really listening to each other and willing to pick up on everything the other one's doing. And you're right, there are long stretches where it's just Cherry and there are long stretches where it's just Rollins. But I have the sense that Rollins regarded Cherry, or at least on the evidence of some of these numbers, Rollins regards Cherry as an equal and someone he can play with, and play in the sense of like play, like have fun with.
Oh, yeah.
And they play well together. They really do, in the sense of have fun together.
Yeah. I don't think anybody, including Cherry, would argue a technical equal, but somebody who is a creative equal, somebody who is able to adventure out with him. And then, of course, in some ways, in terms of adventuresome cred, it is Cherry and Higgins who've been playing with Coleman. And
right.
In a sense, this is about Rollins trying to, in his own way, get to grips with this, yeah, quote-unquote new music.
Yeah. It's, can Rollins be as fearless as Cherry? Because Cherry is a fearless player.
And this is, in another way, I think of the Dexter Gordon date as a great example of what mainstream jazz is. It's just a great, you know, kind of almost platonic ideal of what a small group, mm-hmm, live jazz session would be. If you want what improvisation is about. I feel like this set is, in a sense, everything but the pure atonal, the purely just absolute cutting-edge avant-garde is kind of encapsulated here, going all the way back to Alexander's Ragtime Band to furthest reaches of someplace you can get with any threads left tying you to any kind of tonality. It's all here.
Yeah.
Rollins tries it all, sometimes in the course of a single song. Yeah, these untitled ones, they're not a single motif or idea that gets spread out for 30 minutes. It morphs, it changes, different ideas come up, rhythmic ideas, melodic ideas, feels. I think many of these performances could end, as you said, with a drum roll really several different times.
Yeah.
And instead the momentum goes on and they go somewhere else. Instead of ending, they turn a corner. And then they turn another corner. And yeah, some of it is just literally, it's like, how long can you keep it up? You know, if you experience improvisation for more than 15 minutes in a row, contact your doctor.
Yeah.
And just the sheer physical endurance. This is not an album that could have been made by late middle age or elderly people. I just don't think physically they could do it.
Amazing. I would say again for listeners, this is a sort of a completist's dream or a Rollins fanatic dream or a Cherry fanatic dream. It's demanding. It's not like some box sets. If you laid out for the complete Riverside Monk, it's endlessly pleasant. It's endlessly enjoyable.
Yeah.
Like 16 discs of just fucking heaven. There are very few low moments anywhere on that 16 disc set. This 6-disc set will make your head hurt so much because it's so fucking challenging. Like, it's just, it demands your attention. It is not easy listening. You can't just put it on in the background. This is big boy, engage with me jazz. I can see why for a listener that could be exhausting. Like, I'm exhausted when I listen to some of these 32-minute songs. I mean, I'm just drained by the end of them. And I'm never drained at the end of Blue Monk. I mean, I enjoy the shit out of it. But it doesn't drain me. And that's another way of saying, if you're looking for moment-to-moment pure pleasure, probably Dexter Gordon's live disc is going to give that to you more than this. Just immediate joy. Like, right. If I was going to play one disc for someone who's never heard jazz before, I will play Dexter Gordon because they will grok it almost instantly. Which isn't to say it's shallow. It's just, it's a lot about pleasure and joy and interacting with the listener. This is about the pleasure and joy of the player, and they are definitely giving something to the listener, but it's demanding a great deal from the listener as well. And not everything it's demanding is in terms of just going to give you pure pleasure.
Yeah, and I guess to get back to my weird thing with Getz and Rollins and Coltrane, you know, Coltrane commented once that, well, everybody would sound like Getz if they could. And
right.
Coltrane is one of the great ballad players.
Yes.
And so in terms of lyricism, because Getz, I don't know, he's got a cry in his sound. I don't know how deeply immersed in the blues he is, but he's certainly someone who cares about lyrical expression and someone in a sense who a lot of his career is based on a kind of emotional transparency, right? A caressing. And I think part of the reason this is so rough is that Rollins is just, I don't think Rollins does want to sound like Stan Getz. I just don't think that his personality, his attitude towards music fits in that mold. I just don't think ultimately he's ever been a lyric player. He's a motivic player. He doesn't play improvisations that are largely just based on harmonies. They tend to be based on melodic ideas and kernels. But he's got that just diamond hard, enormous tone, close to hectoring at times. And maybe that's too harsh, but and there tends to be a kind of almost, some of the solos, there's what lightens them is humor, but not there's not a lot of, it's kind of endless. It's like a railroad train going at you for 15 minutes. I mean, there's not a lot of moderation of tone or dynamic. It is just jackhammer intensity, not in the sense of making noise. He's not ready to star on Nipples or something by Brotsman, right? But just in terms of relentless invention, but not necessarily in the service of emotional transparency. And I don't want to say that he's intellectual in the sense of thinking. He is spontaneous. He is extremely, you believe that he's living in the moment, and it's flowing through him and it's coming to him. But it is an art that I think is ultimately of the mind delighting in its own spontaneous play. It's not necessarily about the heart as much. Right. As opposed to both Coltrane and Getz in their own way being very much players partially of emotion and heartfulness. And so, yeah, and Cherry to some degree, too, he is delightful, but I think that Cherry is not an emotionally transparent player. He is, autistic is probably too strong a term, but he's someone who's, you know, shooting out bursts of expression, but he doesn't let you, just his whole approach to the instrument doesn't let you luxuriate in the tone, doesn't let you flow along with the line. It's always a broken line. It's always a fuzzy tone or a smeared tone. It's just the way he expresses himself, and there's a great deal of pleasure in it. And, you know, thank God, can you imagine what would this have been if it had been 7 hours of Rollins and, say, Freddie Hubbard, right?
Oh, God.
That would not have worked. That would have been a bad thing. And Freddie is, in by so many metrics, a better trumpet player than Don Cherry, forward, backwards, and sideways. But in this context, in terms of the spontaneous creativity, and I think Hubbard's got a lot of that too. I mean, I'm not trying to diss him. He's an amazing improviser. But that interaction wouldn't have been there. And they are so well done. And as I said, some of these songs, it is amazing. Having listened to jazz musicians interact with one another for 35 years or whatever, this is just an amazing example of that. It is a rare example of it. And it is, if you are interested in the art of improvisation or thinking about Sonny Rollins as an artist, really, I'd say at it maybe his most critical phase, you can't miss this. Thank God it exists. I mean, my guess is he never would have approved his release, and RCA couldn't have gotten clearance from him if he wanted to. I'm sure their contract has expired. So these guys in Spain, where the copyright laws are fairly lax, took it upon themselves and somehow got what sounds like a pretty fucking good tape. I don't know where it came from, and made just, you know, this is an important release. It's a must hear if you love this music, but I would absolutely agree with Mike. This is not something to dip your toes in.
Right.
You gotta brace yourself. And I would not recommend listening to more than one disc in a row unless you're a stronger man than I am, Gunga Din.
Or you're doing a podcast and you have to get through them. But this was one of those occasions where my way of listening to these, the first time I listened to every disc in order, but then after that, it's just on random repeat for the podcast. And I can tell you that as much as I love these guys, when a 34-minute song came up, I'm like, oh God, okay, I gotta listen to this.
Yeah.
All right, you know, get ready. But concentrate.
Yeah, it's very different from the kind of obsessive focus you might get with a Coltrane, in that they tend to morph, they tend to turn corners. It's just that there's an arbitrariness about the length of it. In other words, why don't you turn two corners and then drink a glass of water and then start up on the corner three? They don't. They just go 35 minutes. They turn seven corners. And so there isn't that. It's not monomaniacal. It's just relentless. It just goes on and on. It's just like your imagination never stops. You never run out of ideas. You never run out of air. You can just go forever and ever. It's like, bring me another woman. I'm not done yet. You know? Like, my God, Sonny, we're running out. The nuttery's almost empty. Stop, stop. Nope, I need another one. So, yeah, just, I'm so glad this exists. You don't want to miss this. In some ways, I think that it makes more sense of Our Man in Jazz than Our Man in Jazz makes by itself. It's hard to explain it, but just getting one little sliver of what they're up to, it's like a laboratory experiment they're doing for 7 hours.
Right. By the same token, tell the listeners, if they don't want all these discs, just get Our Man in Jazz.
And if you just hate it, don't, you know, you're not going to change your mind. It's just, it somehow makes more sense in the larger context. But absolutely, everybody, stream Our Man in Jazz first.
Right.
See what you think about it.
Not everyone needs this. Let's put it that way.
No. Not even.
Some people need this. A much smaller set of people need this than people who need to listen to like several of Sonny's discs from different periods.
Saxophone Colossus, Way Out West. My
essential.
God.
Essential. Must listen to jazz. Yeah.
This is
must listen for a certain subset of listeners. We're not sort of putting people down or anything. We're just saying if you don't have the patience for this, then don't do it. Why suffer? You know, I mean, it's just going to make you suffer. So
well,
don't do it.
Said suffering's good for you. You need to listen to this. Don't listen to Mike. Just make yourself feel the burn. Yeah, I guess my point.
I would hate to be someone who dropped $100 on this and was like,
"Oh no, it's like 20."
This hurts.
That's the nice thing about Spanish bootlegs is they aren't that expensive. So this is not, this is not a luxury product. It's not a luxury price. It's quite reasonable. And I don't know, maybe it's streaming somewhere. I don't know, but it's wow. It is. Yeah, this is important.
It's monumental. It's monumental.
I guess my point is that there are legitimate questions about the chemistry between these guys and. I think that whatever you think of this, this is not a curate's egg collector's item that we're just so excited because it's fairly new and it hasn't been out there before and it's something else to slot in on our shelf. But ultimately, we're going to listen to it once or twice and go back to the classics. Like you might say about some Miles Davis releases sometimes, you know, as they dig into the vaults and you're like, this is great, but it's finally not. I mean, to me, this is if you want to get into this mid-period Rollins the Searcher, Rollins on the Quest. This is really good stuff. This is not second-rate stuff. This is, I'm so glad they found it. It is an important archival find as opposed to, hey, I'm glad that's there. I'll put that on my shelf. I'll listen to it once or twice. I think it's bigger than that. Anyway, thank you for putting up with that. I know it was a journey, but man, it was fun. Has to be around you. I can't stand you lying. You got any lighter stuff on your mind? Any pop stuff?
I've listened to a handful of things. The only new, a fair amount of new stuff. The most recent new thing that I've picked up that I find relatively interesting, not great, is Iggy Pop's release from last year called Post-Pop Depression, recorded with, who the hell is the dude who helped him with this? Matt Helders, I think.
It's like somebody from some other band.
Queens of the Stone Age.
There you go.
And what's kind of interesting about it is this dude who came together with Iggy Pop to make this album decided that Iggy Pop's best music was made with David Bowie. And so we're going to make Iggy Pop music that reminds us all of Iggy Pop in Berlin with Bowie, right down to the backing vocal sounding like Bowie at times.
Oh, weird. Okay.
And it's pretty good. If I had to listen to a lot of Iggy Pop, that's one part of Iggy I kind of would like to hear. So it's not bad. I don't think it's great. I don't think it stands up to his best work. But for a guy who's been making music now for, a billion years, and who looks like he's been making music for a billion years, it's pretty good. It's not like when Lou Reed played with Metallica. That was like an abortion that should have happened.
Okay,
you know,
I'll take your word for it. Never heard of it.
This isn't that. This is pretty decent. Have you ever seen that film Coffee and Cigarettes?
No, I think. You or somebody loaned it to me and it's still on my shelf someday. I'll have to watch it.
Coffee and Cigarettes is a movie by Jim Jarmusch. And all it is people drinking coffee and smoking cigarettes. And it's mostly people you've seen before, famous people, but they sometimes are playing characters. So anyway, the reason I mentioned this is the scene involving Iggy Pop in this particular set is Iggy Pop meets Tom Waits at a cafe.
Oh my God.
And the two of them drink coffee and smoke cigarettes. And of the two of them, of course, Tom Waits is the more natural actor. And the way they play the scene, Waits is like calm and cool. And Iggy is like totally nervous and skittery and talking too much and hyper. Not I've struck out on drugs way, but in a like, I'm just an insecure 50-year-old way. And This feels like the album an insecure 50-year-old would make, except he's like 75 at this point. but it's pretty good. It's pretty good. He's in decent voice. And okay. I don't think any huge fan of Iggy and Iggy's Berlin period would hear this and go, oh, those fuckers. I think they'd go like, okay, they tried to get that sound. They sort of got it sometimes, and it's not bad. So that's how I feel about it. It's pretty good.
Okay.
It's worth a listen.
Yeah, I've never been a huge Iggy partisan, but I probably should dial that up sometime.
Yeah.
Okay, real quickly on my end, just a shout out to Papas Fritas, if I said that wrong, and I'm sure I did. That's what the internet said. I listened to Helioself again. I learned about this group because Ivy covered one of their songs on their brilliant cover
album.
You
think everything Ivy does is brilliant.
I do. And this is just a neat album, whether it's 80s or 90s. It's back in the day, but it's a kind of a weird mix of pop and punk. It's really much more pop, but it's, you know, kind of lo-fi production values. The singers aren't all brilliant. The songs are really well written, good bones, lots of fun. Just kind of a group and a album you may have missed if you're a little younger than we are, and it's definitely worth looking up. It was a lot of fun. More recently, listen to Angel Olsen's My Woman. And yeah, I couldn't decide. Is like, does she want to be produced by Phil Spector or David Lynch? It's a little hard to tell. Good alto voice, good deep voice, good singer. Kind of a self-conscious, primitive take on the songwriting. I like the first half a lot. The second half, some of the songs run 5 minutes or more. I don't think they quite earn it. So I can't decide. It's one of those things that if you don't like singers who seem like at some level they're being affected, you will not like this record because the whole thing seems to be kind of doing a thing rather than Angel just being herself, whatever that would mean.
I like her release, the previous release I have, Burn Your Fire for No Witness.
I haven't heard that. I'd be really curious to hear it because this
pretty good
seems to be going for a very specific, sort of like girl group roots.
Yeah, yeah.
Very, you know, songs about love and my desire and this sort of thing. A fine singer.
I would
singer.
Just point out, to make you feel as old as I feel, uh-huh, that Angel Olsen is from Chicago, and okay, she was born our senior year in college. Just a heads up on that.
Yeah, yeah, I know. God damn
it. Don't
I
you feel fucking ancient?
I do every day anyway. So, yeah, I would like to hear something else by her. I think, in a sense, if you're a natural good singer, the hope always is you'll stumble across a good context. Whereas if you aren't, you've just got to be a good producer or a writer because nothing can save you otherwise. So my hope is that the context get more interesting or she finds a better songwriting partner or they tighten things up in the back half a bit on the next one. But I liked it overall.
They say you're angry and rant mightily because I love the same as you.
And then finally, I want to talk briefly, visiting my parents. I watched a couple films with them, films that would never have occurred to me to watch on my own. And one of them was called Sing, and it was about a bunch of animals.
I've heard about it. I've seen the previews. Is it as funny as it looks?
I barely knew this film existed. And back in the day, when we were cultural studies mavens, and you still are to some degree, I am not, we talk about things like the erasure of labor. And I remember as a kid who'd worked on the yard crew at my school, watching Stephen King's The Stand miniseries and saying, who the fuck is mowing all those lawns if everybody's dead? Because it just, you realize, it's like, look, okay, No, labor is what keeps the grass short. If everyone's dead, the grass is now long. You think through your premise. And it's just because we can take for granted the grass and corporations and other places is magically kept short, magically by people we don't care about or watch, that we ignore the fact that it should be long if everyone's
dead. Okay, Pat.
Uh-huh.
Where's the landing strip? Where are the lights? We're in the fog. Okay.
In this film, same deal going on. We have a singing contest, various animals, and there's no ideology of animals. Zootopia is a film that thinks a little bit about its,
yes,
conceit.
Yes.
This is,
yes,
a film that does not give a flying fuck about its conceit. It's just there's animals. A panda once, or a koala, rather, is running this decrepit theater, and it's going to save it by having a singing contest. So the first odd thing is all these animals line up. There's gorillas and slugs and just every animal from the animal kingdom. And you see the auditions, and I've never seen a presentation like this. You know who the people are going to win because you follow their stories briefly. There's the frustrated mother pig who's got 25 piglets, and she's ignored at home and overworked, and she wants to sing. And the shy elephant, et cetera, et cetera. But every audition, you'd think, what's going to happen at most of the auditions on the premise where you've got the guy selecting people for the big show? What are the most of the auditions going to be like, right? Mike doesn't know.
I don't know. What are they going to be like?
Well, they're going to suck, right? It's just horrible, 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 and then the few shining stars. Everybody's good. Everybody's good.
Oh, okay.
So it's this weird world where everyone is a professional-level singer. It just seems odd to me right there. There's some erasure. It's like, isn't this kind of a talent that only a few people have? And then as they're working on their various shows, one is a punk rock porcupine voiced by Scarlett Johansson with a bad boyfriend who she has to leave. He's a bad porcupine. Her climactic number, which is quote-unquote self-written, she's out there strumming a guitar, and she's got a whole punk band behind her. But I realized in none of these performances, there are no other musicians. It's like, where does the backing music come from? It's like the lawns in the stand. Is it taped? How would they tape a backing track to a song that was just written by a grumpy porcupine? I mean, couldn't you just come up with an animal backing band that was like, I don't know, Paul Schaefer on the and just played everything? I mean, I'm willing to, there are bands like this, but I guess the animation budget didn't stretch to a bunch of, I don't know, armadillos or something in the background. What the fuck?
There's a small part of me. Is this rant done? I don't want to interrupt you because you're in full flow and you're going quite well. Is this rant done or is there more?
I think largely more? It's petering off. But the ideology of this film has fascinated me. It's like everybody can sing and no one needs to play any instruments because they just magically come out of the air when you're performing. Anyway, rant over.
So part of me wants to say to you in the immortal words of Sergeant Hulka in the early Bill Murray Harold Ramis film Stripes, lighten up, Francis. What the fuck? It's an animated movie about singing animals, and you're subjecting it to Marxian labor analysis. You fucking idiot. What's your problem? Drink some more wine. It'll be okay. Secondly, I just want to ask, apart from its, you know, incomplete labor theory of value, did you enjoy the film?
It's not good. God knows it's not
okay.
Good. But the music is not bad. And in fact, the tender, heartfelt gorilla who is trying to get out of the gorilla gang run by his father so he can sing. You hear him singing a snatch of a Believe the Zombies song. It's like The Way I Feel. It's like an a cappella song they do. It's a single, The Way I Feel Inside. And I'm like, okay, that's a tasteful callback to a track most people aren't going to know. And it ends with the shy elephant, who I think is some kind of YouTube personality or contest winner, doing a really amazing version of the Stevie Wonder song, Oh Don't You Worry About a Thing. And I'm like, okay, that's a pretty fucking good song. And it's you know, I don't know if it's better than his version, but it's got a lot more notes. So overall, the music is decent. I mean, there is absolutely no musical ideology. It's just whatever crap. Of course, they do Shake It Off, and they do. It's just, I guess there's no country. And the other odd thing about it is one of the characters is a mouse, and he plays saxophone, but he also sings like Frank Sinatra. And he is the one character in the film who's obviously a complete self-centered asshole. He's a true jazz bastard. His name is Mike, just saying. And he's played by Seth MacFarlane, who is actually, I never heard his, he's a pretty good singer.
Oh,
I
mean, Seth MacFarlane is a huge fan of music, and on Family Guy, like, they have three or four like musical shows a season, and since he's doing three quarters of the voices on the show, he's singing with himself most of the time. And he is serious. You know, he would like to have been a singer, and he's actually pretty good.
Yeah, so I because I didn't know, it's like, is this Buble? I don't know. I'm not breaking out in a rash, but it could be. You know, who's playing the asshole mouse? As someone pointed out, he's got a tiny little saxophone that he can play take five on when he's playing for money. And the thing. But for every animal, the microphone is still the same size. So he's literally like climbing on top of it to sing or whatever, being flung around. So they don't have little tiny animal microphones, but they've made miniaturized saxophones. I don't know if this film makes sense. Oh, the other great thing is the Mama Pig, to win this contest, and the plot hook is they're going to have a contest. Whoever wins it will get $1,000, which is absolutely every penny the poor koala bear can scrape together. But his assistant screws up, and it turns out to be $100,000. So the pig, to get in the contest, invents a mechanism that will feed, clothe, and send off to school every one of her 25 children and find the car keys for her hapless husband. And it occurs to me, if you can make that invention, you don't need $100,000 from a singing contest. You're going to be rich, bitch. Just market that. So, yeah, I thought way too much about that film.
You thought way
too much. What else am I going to do? I'm sitting here. It's like, with the rents, can't leave, can't play Zelda, got to watch it, might as well think. Erasure of Labor Man, Marx, read it, then watch Sing. There's a sheep in it.
Well, now that I've got that off my chest, I can announce that that concludes episode 114 of the Jazz Bastard Podcast. As always, you can reach us at mike@jazzbastard.com or pat@jazzbastard.com. We do check our emails intermittently and always appreciate hearing from you. You can also reach us at our Facebook page, which I hope to post to a little bit less intermittently, but no promises. Tune in next time as we discuss mostly vocalists with appearances by Al Jarreau, Somi, and Robert Glasper, along with an outlier, Toshinori Kondo. Until next time, take care.